I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to this week's Sparks. Concern grows over gene patenting as American businessmen plan to buy out vital British research. FM interference problems and interference to the new B Sky B comedy channel may be no joke. Valve lunacy. Did you notice the natural acoustic sound of our 6205 transmitter modulator? The Japanese pay £30,000 for something similar. Enough hype, songs should sell themselves, a report from the US. Russian rock radio, digital cinema sound, and BBC Radio Berkshire comes on air. It's all in Sparks this week from Radiofax, 3910 6205 and 12255.
Two items here from Media Network.
Dr. Kim Andrew Elliott in Washington, D.C., though, reports an interesting compact disc he's found in a local store. It's called Rock Radio Vietnam, issued by KTEL International. In between the remastered music of the 1970s are original recordings from Saigon.
KSVN, another hour of Good morning. Welcome into a Wednesday from Saigon. Army Specialist Jim Ambrose on the Orient Express. Gonna shake up your soul now. Delaney, Bonnie, and friends.
So that's a compact disc called Rock Radio Vietnam, available at least in the United States, and it's issued by KTEL International. Next to Russia, presently seeing amazing levels of innovation and inventiveness in radio. Here's part of the story about Radio Allah, where music is the message.
Michael Kerr, who lives in Gwent in the UK, says he's fascinated by a station called Radio Allah. So we sent Vasily Strelnikov in Moscow to investigate.
That's the voice of the Moscow-based private radio station Radio Allah, saying 24 hours of the latest news and songs by the bards. Although primarily intended for listeners in Russia, the station is picked up by many curious listeners around the world. I met with Radio Allah's music editor, Sergei Alyanovsky, and asked him what's the station's aim.
We're trying to popularize the genre of the bards. We think many people are interested. It's a form of music which has developed into something unique. It combines the best lyrics and music. There are elements of folk, romances, and gypsy music. There are some songs that resemble Scottish, Irish, or Spanish ballads. But I'd like to say that the Russian bard music is very specific, and you need to know something about our country's history to fully appreciate it.
Well, judging by the letters and phone calls to the station, Sergei Alyanovsky says Radio Allah listeners are diverse. From children to old people, to sailors out at sea, and to the handicapped. Sergei explains the universal appeal of bard music from a scientific standpoint.
Lately, medical studies have shown that the combination of the acoustic guitar and the human voice have a soothing effect on people. Rock music tends to excite and sometimes annoys people. But if you listen to bard music, you experience tranquility. And independent studies back this up. Take this example. Our broadcasts are fed by cable to factory workshops for the disabled. Now, it seems that when people there are able to listen to the music, they're more relaxed and productivity increases. I guess there's less stress.
Radio Allah uses former Gostel transmitters and rents studio and office space in the same building as Radio Moscow World Service.
No, we are interested in listeners' comments and reception reports. We want to know where we're being heard. In fact, we've just received a bunch of letters from Hong Kong and Australia, where we've been heard by satellite. Also, sailors at sea listen to us and call us at our studio number, using ship-to-shore communications. The most recent calls have come from ships off the coast of Britain and Portugal.
Satellite? Now this is where the mysteries begin.
We don't intend to sound mysterious. Our style is designed to use as few words as possible. The music's the most important thing. And when we do speak, we don't intend to reflect just one particular viewpoint. It's simply uncluttered human contact.
Good thing they're not trying that in the North Sea, or they'd soon be in trouble. That was Vasily Strolnikov's report on Media Network from Radio Netherlands about Radio Allah, which transmits on medium wave 684 and 1368 from St. Petersburg, and on short waves between 07 and 17 hours on 11685 and 11965, and between 17 and 07 hours on 5040 and 6015.
I've been scribbling them down as fast as I can, because I'll have to have a listen out to that. Sounds absolutely fascinating. I've been wondering what's been happening to radio in Russia. We should have a few more reports from Russia in weeks to come. And has anyone ever heard, apart from me, Vasily Strolnikov, as he used to be on Radio Moscow, presenting the TASS Top 10? This extraordinary programme was sent down on a tape, because at my old university station we used to receive Radio Moscow tapes, and this was quite amazing. It was Russian sort of rock and pop bands into a top 10 program presented by very lively Vasily Strolnikov. It's a pity they didn't continue it. I think we only ever received about three programs. Does anyone else remember the TASS top 10? So, onto a letter from Mike Evans, who lives in Buckhurst Hill in Essex. I enjoy your archive programmes. Being out of work, I listen to your programming most days of the week. I particularly like Sparks. In fact, I've been tuning your way since the first time you started. He listens on an NRD-505. His antenna is a half-size G5RV tuned via a JMatch ATU. That's Mike Evans. He also hand-makes medium-wave loop aerials. There's a data sheet here. It looks well made, and he charges £32.15, which is a very good price. So if you're looking for a loop aerial, you could write to Mike Evans at 120 Loughton Way, Buckhurst Hill, in Essex, IG96AR. That's for details on Mike Evans' medium-wave loop aerial, 120 Loughton Way, Buckhurst Hill, Essex, IG96AR. And he asks if you could send a stamped addressed envelope, or two international reply coupons, or $1.
My dress.
And speaking of medium wave loop aerials, here's more news on something to listen out for.
Next to something unusual these days in London, a medium wave pirate. I was first alerted to this by Jodie, who does Jodie's Rock Show. She heard it driving around London. Apparently quite a good signal almost everywhere. It's on 819.1 kHz, and I first found it on New Year's Eve, and it's been on and off since then. It has an ident, which sounds like this. It's called The Edge. The Edge there, on 819.1, a characteristic 100Hz beat note, which has been heard as far away as Norwich in Norfolk and Basingstoke in Hampshire. Look out for that, medium wave DXs. That may not be on frequency, but at least it's properly modulated. Unlike the licensed station 1413 kHz Sunrise Radio from Isleworth in West London, which has been pushing out a disgraceful signal for some time now.
Your point of view on Sunrise Radio. Dial 569-4400.
Abtar Lit, the man of the people.
Welcome back.
Truly gross distortion there, even with synchronicity modulation. Hang an oscilloscope on the end of your 455 kHz IF strip and have a look at it if you're within range. Not permitted by the Radio Authority's regulations to go beyond 100% modulation. That's a National Transcommunications Limited installation at the transmitter site, licensed by the Radio Authority, responsibility for enforcement with the Renew Communications Agency of the DTI. But at least that's about the only incremental station actually making money. That's Sunrise Radio, 1413 kHz from West London.
Whose managing director, Abtar Lit, also does quite a lot of the programming, it seems. You're listening to Radio Facts, 6205, 3910 and 12255, and today it's our technical, media and scientific news programme, Sparks. Comedy Channel picture quality is not a joke, in Electronics Weekly. Britain's satellite television subscribers with 60-centimetre dishes attached to their roofs may not be laughing later this month when they watch the Comedy Channel broadcast by B Sky B. Interference from signals broadcast from satellites owned by European operator Eutelsat, in which BT has a stake, may impair picture quality for B Sky B's 2 million UK subscribers when Eutelsat starts broadcasting later this month. Despite claims that the risk was negligible in the UK, a spokesman for B Sky B admitted last week there was a remote possibility of picture interference on the Comedy Channel, particularly if the 60-centimetre dishes are incorrectly installed. Société Européenne des Satellites, SES, which owns the two Astra satellites which B Sky B uses, says the threat of interference from the Eutelsat 2 satellite is serious enough for it to be considering legal action to prevent Eutelsat from broadcasting on the offending channels. Dr. Pierre Meyrat, Director General at SES, hit out at Eutelsat. Eutelsat sees Astra's use of 60-centimetre dishes as a commercial advantage, and they want to force everyone to use 85-centimetre dishes, he said. Such a move would be a serious blow for the UK's satellite TV market, as dishes over 80 centimetres would require planning permission before being installed. One in seven UK households could have a satellite dish by the end of the year, they go on to say. Market researchers predict Britain's 2 million dishes will rise to 3 million by the end of 1992. That report by Richard Wilson in Electronics Weekly. Thanks to Colin Ferris, who writes to us from Kempston in Bedford. He listens on 3910 with a Sony ICF 2001D. with a built-in telescopic rod aerial. I also have at my listening post a Sony ICF-7600D and a Yaesu FRG-7. You lucky lad. Reception was of fairly good quality, he reports. Well, Colin Ferris, thank you very much. Scandal of US bid to buy vital British research. In The Observer, by Robin McKee, publicly funded gene project at risk from big money lure. One of the world's leading scientific projects, funded by British taxpayers for the past 20 years, may be bought out by American entrepreneurs. A group of American scientists and businessmen is trying to take over the Nematode project, based in Cambridge. The Americans' aim is to monopolize technologies vital to the human genome program, which is expected to be the most important source of new drugs and medical techniques in the 21st century. Work on this project, described by a Nobel Prize winner as the jewel in the crown of UK science, has only recently reached fruition, and it is feared the group's aim is to gain a stranglehold over the development of these medicines. This is a flagrant bid to create an IBM of human genetics, said Dr. Di Rees, Secretary of Britain's Medical Research Council, which has funded the Nematode project for most of its life. I'm very worried. Last night, the project's leader, Dr. John Sulston, of the Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, confirmed he had received an offer, which he described as extremely interesting. Nothing has been decided yet, he added. The buyout bid has also dismayed academics in America. Nobel Prize winner James Watson, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, is flying to London on Friday to meet Dr. Rees to work out a strategy to halt the takeover. As director of the US National Center of Human Genome Research, Dr. Watson has also provided funds for the Nematode project. This is a beautiful piece of research, the jewel in the crown of British science, he said. It would be a serious setback for the science to lose it. It would also be a major blow to the delicate international collaborations we're trying to set up. The expertise gained from it should be available to all scientists. The nematode is a tiny soil worm made up of fewer than 1,000 cells, compared with a newborn human, which is made up of 10 million million cells. Nevertheless, it has organs and a primitive nervous system, and it can be bred every 3 days. These features have allowed scientists to study nematodes in unsurpassed detail. The positions of 98% of the worm's genes have been plotted. While pilot experiments for working out the individual structure of some genes, a process known as sequencing, have also been enormously successful. The group is close to making the first complete instruction book for a living multicellular creature. It is this success that has attracted scientists such as Dr. Leroy Hood of the California Institute of Technology. Dr. Sulston's expertise would give any company a massive advantage when work begins on creating a similar instruction book for mankind, a task that will involve the sequencing of all 100,000 genes that control our development and growth. Dr. Hood has persuaded a major backer, Frederick Bork, a 45-year-old businessman married to Eleanor Clay Ford, granddaughter of motor tycoon Henry Ford, to provide $50 million to create a new gene sequencing company to be based in Seattle. Mr. Bork's companies include the quietly lucrative firm of Bork & Matthews, which builds million-dollar homes in Connecticut. However, his proposed genetics company, which has yet to be given a name, will have a very different, controversial profile. Although it is still in the process of formation, its science directors have already begun to poach top scientists, starting with Dr. Sulston. Essentially, they've offered him a blank check and the best-equipped laboratory in America to finish his work several years ahead of schedule. We intend to carry out sequencing 10 times faster than anyone else in the world, and John Sulston would be the perfect candidate to lead that work, said Dr. Hood. The prospect of losing Dr. Sulston has not amused the head of his present laboratory, however. Professor Aaron Klug, a Nobel Prize winner, said, "This is an extremely distasteful business. This project was created with British public money. Now people are trying to move it out of the public domain without anything coming back." Professor Klug was also very worried that attempts to patent human genes in order to exploit them commercially would only be made worse by the creation of the new company. However, this charge was rejected by Professor Charles Cantor, a molecular biologist at the University of California in Berkeley, and another founder of the new company. "We intend to make money by sequencing, not patenting human genes, and we want the best scientists in the field. That's why we want Dr. Sulston. In the meantime, Dr. Rees of the MRC is now trying to raise the £2 million a year needed to provide facilities that will match those in Seattle and keep the nematode project in Britain. "I think our chances of success are only 50-50, he said recently. That in the Observer. All that fuss about a tiny little worm. However, if these companies are allowed to start patenting human genes, where could it end? If they, say, owned over 50%, then you might have to pay royalties before you could have children. An extraordinary thought and something that needs to be addressed before the next century, otherwise we could find ourselves in a lot of trouble."
With the purple umbrella and a 50% hand. Live it, love it. Just a warm up the school out loud in her age Cadillac. Live it, love it. Just a warm up. Come on, babe, on the roundabout. Right on the miracle route. We all know what the name is, so you better lay your money down.
Dolby give early demonstrations of their digital cinema sound system in Studio Sound. Dolby Laboratories make no bones about announcing and demonstrating their new digital cinema sound system at an early stage of development. It works, but has not yet been tested in the field to find out if there are any hidden flaws. There are two ways of evaluating Dolby's early move. It could be to stymie Kodak's thrust on CDS, cinema digital sound, or to give the film industry advance warning of an alternative system that they would have backed instead of CDS if only they had known about it early enough. Take your pick. To recap, Kodak have worked for the last 3 years with the Optical Radiation Corporation of Azusa, California on CDS. The area normally occupied by the analog soundtrack is replaced by tiny black and white spots, representing digital code. Both Kodak and ORC found they had been working separately on a similar system, so pooled resources. CDS is a six-channel system, like 70mm magnetic. Five channels of sound are spread across the screen and round the cinema, and a sixth channel carries deep bass for music and special effects from all directions. Two extra digital channels convey code for synchronizing other equipment, such as screen curtains, laser light shows, or even electronic musical instruments. CDS is coded to a similar standard as domestic compact disc, and all eight code streams are interleaved to create a single digital stream running at 5.5 megabits per second. For recording onto film, this single stream is subdivided into 180 parallel streams, which are recorded in the soundtrack area as 180 very narrow parallel tracks. Each contains tiny black or white dots representing digital ones and zeros. Under a microscope, the soundtrack area looks like a chessboard. The projector is fitted with a CCD sensor, with a 512 individual light-sensitive spots in a line lying across the film. The CCD remains stationary, but however much the film weaves sideways while running through the projector, a block of 180 sensors can always align accurately with the 180 film tracks. Kodak ORC have built CDS on the premise that it is impossible to record both analog and digital soundtracks on the same print, with compatibility between digital and analog projectors. Dolby started with the premise that the only way to make digital sound fly is to release single inventory prints that will play on either analog or digital projectors, and Dolby wanted six tracks to match 70mm magnetic. First, Dolby engineers tried putting a digital track on the edge of the film, outside the sprocket holes, but this area is already used by some cinemas for ancillary equipment control, for instance, opening and closing the screen curtains. Then, they tried putting digital code in the black frame line at the top and bottom of the picture, but in CinemaScope format films, the frame line is so narrow as to be virtually non-existent. The next idea was to try putting the digital sound in the space between the sprocket holes, and this is the basis for Dolby's new SRD system. The six channels of sound are first converted into digital code of studio quality by sampling at 48 kHz and coding in 16-bit words. The encoder then reduces the data rate with a digital compression system based on psychoacoustic masking, as pioneered for digital audio broadcasting and already used by Dolby for its digital transmission system. A loud sound at one frequency will always mask quieter sounds of the same or similar frequency. So, the encoder splits the audible frequency band into several hundred separate frequency bins, each just a few tens of hertz wide. At any instant, some bins will contain no signal, others low-level signal, and others high-level signal. The encoder dissects the sound in each bin using the technique known as Fourier analysis, which relies on the fact that even the most complex sound signal can always be represented by a series of smooth sine waves. The encoder then allocates each bin only the number of bits needed to code audible sounds. This reduces the number of bits needed per second for six channels by at least 85%. The encoder then breaks the stream of bits down into 96 blocks and records them in the hitherto blank areas of film between the sprocket holes. The bits on the film appear as constantly changing black and white dots. The only modification needed to run a digital film is attachment of a CCD scanner to the top of the projector, as with CDS. The scanner delivers intermittent blocks of data, which the decoder assembles into a continuous stream and splits into six parallel sound channels and a data channel that carries a 9.6 kilobits per second code, for automating cinema functions, for instance opening and closing the curtains and starting and stopping projectors. Dolby Laboratories claim that existing film recorders can be used to print digital soundtracks, and for mass production these can run at up to 20 times normal film running speed. The sound is read 2.5 seconds ahead of the picture. Some of this time is used for buffering and processing the blocks. The rest is used as a variable delay, so that synchronization between the picture and sound signals can be adjusted to suit the size of theatre and distance between the audience and screen and loudspeakers. The system conceals minor digital errors by repeating the last block of data. If a series of blocks is damaged, for instance, if the projectionist has wrongly laced the projector and damaged the sprocket holes, the sound system switches automatically to read the analog soundtracks for as long as the damage lasts. By running the same loop of film over and over again, Dolby has shown that the digital sound is likely to last longer than the picture. Splices cause a brief moment of silence. It has to be said the results are truly remarkable. Dolby say it will soon upgrade the coding system to 18 bits. Now that Dolby has offered a single inventory digital system which is compatible with analog film projectors, it is hard to see how Kodak and ORC can carry on with CDS. There just cannot be any future for a double inventory system if similar results are available from a single inventory system. That was by Barry Fox about digital cinema sound in Studio Sound.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax. A letter from Walter Mola from Torino in Italy. I'm 34 years old. I work as a dealer of mechanical parts and tools. My hobby is shortwave listening since 1973. Your reception is easy in the morning and in the evenings and nights. The programmes are very interesting, and in the last days I've listened many times to your good music, and this night your programme about old pirate stations. My receiver is an JRC525, and antenna is external inverted V, 20 metres in length. Thanks very much, Walter Mola, who writes from Torino in Italy. And look forward to receiving a letter from you. I guarantee to read bits of it out on air. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And if you'd like to send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1, we'll send you back our station card, along with details, technical details, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. So the address to write to us is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
Recently there's been a new publication launched all about pirate radio. Here's Andy Walker on WNKR reviewing issue number 2.
And loads of other small bits and pieces of radio news. The whole true story. Do you know what happened with Radio Harmony? Do you know the true story? Well, you can find it out in FRQ issue number 2. There's a small feature on Mi Amigo, the shortwave pirate run by Terry Phillips. Who's he? I've never heard of him. And were you interested in the Britain Radio all-time top 40? Well, the whole top 40 is printed in issue number 2 of FRQ. The Anorak Almanac lists all those great free radio dates you'd need to know and love and store in your brain cell, plus the FRQ database, the quarterly free radio directory of shortwave listing throughout the UK and Europe. And there's just pages and pages with the addresses and frequencies and everything, with the frequency watch and the famous last words, it is the bargain of the month. Checks and postals payable to wavelength £1.50 to FRQ PO Box 112 Crewe in Cheshire CW27DS issue number 2 of FRQ PO Box 112 Crewe Cheshire CW27DS and it's £1.50. Make
a truly massive signal there from WNKR on 6400. Talking about Free Radio Quarterly.
WNKR, we've got a CB radio echo mic and we're going to use it.
Moving.
developed in 1919, discovered in 1991, the General Electric 211 valve. An almost forgotten valve from more than 50 years ago could be about to take valve amplifiers into a new century. Alan Sercombe listens to a prototype and tells the story. Noel Keywood explains the background. This in Hi-Fi World. The General Electric GL211 bright emitter triode valve first appeared in 1919. It was originally intended for use in a telephone line amplifier, but was quickly adopted for transmitting and audio use. Early valves were fragile. This was one of the first ruggedized designs. Known as the VT-4C to the military, it followed on from the VT-1 and VT-2 of 1917. They are all part of a family of triodes designed between 1913 and 1935, culminating in the much-vaunted 300B valve, which found use in cinemas. Because of the 211's rugged design compared to the valves of the day, it was quickly pressed into service by the United States Signal Corps for use in transportable tank, battlefield, and boat transmitters. In audio, the 211 was used in a variety of applications, including the Westrex cinema amplifiers. Being popular, it is thought that at least 15 valve manufacturers were simultaneously producing the 211 in the USA alone, before the Second World War. The 211-based military and cinema equipment had been largely superseded by the end of the war. The valve became widely available as an army surplus item in the States as a result. They were soon widely distributed around the world as part of a United States foreign aid program. Distant war-torn countries begging the US of A for food, tools, and clothing. What do they get? A transmitter valve. Although many of these valves became the centerpiece of home-built Far Eastern audio amplifiers of the 50s and 60s, the supplies of the 211 went largely unnoticed elsewhere for many years. In Europe and the US, where the valve's audio application is almost unknown, the 211 became a long-forgotten memory. Things were different in the Far East, however. In Japan, noted designer and reviewer Kitty Muraoka, later referred to as the Audio Professor, designed kit amplifiers based around the 211, along with many other triodes back in the late 50s and 60s. It seems that because of the Japanese penchant for big efficient horn loudspeakers in small rooms, they had little need for high power amplifiers and could utilize the advantages of the triode, despite the relatively low power of the amplifier designs that used it. Towards the close of the 1970s, two well-respected designers in Europe, Bei Yamamura and Eric Anderson, were working with the similar but higher powered 845 valve. At the same time in Japan, Hiroyasu Kondo was developing no-feedback, single-ended designs using these valves, which culminated in the 211-based audio note Ongaku, roughly translating as music in Japanese. Around 1982, Peter Watson of Selectron, also known as PM Components, was on one of his valve-hunting expeditions in Europe when he discovered a cache of 211 valves belonging to a French scrap merchant. These had been left behind by the US Army Signal Corps after World War II. Today, the 211 valve is undergoing a renaissance. For the first time since the end of the Second World War, the valve is being manufactured again, in China, under the Shuanggang brand name. A great deal of renewed interest has been created by the £34,000 audio note Ongaku. This design, costing over £1,000 per watt, takes the single-ended application of 211 almost to its limits, with about 5 pounds of silver wire in the transformers alone. Its appearance, price, and sound quality have done a lot to turn heads and bend ears towards 211 amplification in Britain. Currently, only the audio note Ongaku is available in this country, but several less expensive designs are snapping at its solid silver heels. In the US, Carey Audio have spoken of a 211 amplifier to match their Western Electric 300B and other famous triode power amplifiers. British-based Grove Valve Amplifiers are about to launch the Nephthys, which we were fortunate enough to have a brief listen to, while the Japanese still produce kit amplifiers based around the 211. Still more manufacturers are looking at the similar but higher-powered 845. We can expect a rush of vintage triode valve amplifiers to start appearing soon, now that the manufacturer of the valves has been restarted. The Grove Vale Audio Nephthys monoblocks, expected to be around £4,000 a pair, are the first. Prototypes lived in my system for a week. As such a detailed analysis of the amplifiers would be unfair, the overall sound quality is worth comment. Various problems did manifest themselves. The monoblocks were noisy, both mechanically and in terms of hiss through the speakers. Much of this is due to the off-the-shelf transformers used in the pre-production model. I've been assured that the Grove-designed transformers will eradicate a large proportion of this hum and noise in production models. In light of this, it was all the more surprising that when warmed up, the amplifier had the ability to almost completely disappear when music was played. While the overall presentation may be a little too saccharine for some, the Nephthys is extraordinarily listenable as an amplifier. It destroys any suggestion that valve amplifiers do not deal with bass properly. Bass was deep, tight, rhythmic, and far better controlled than that of many solid-state designs. The Nephthys offers a sense of reality difficult for conventional amplifiers to achieve. But giving everything a natural acoustic and air, the whole system vanishes, allowing the listener to sit in on the recording session. It has a slight tendency to bathe everything in a sweet light, while gritty music is accurately portrayed. It smoothes over the roughest edges. That aside, the Nephthys is capable of some of the most natural performances outside a live event. Where it misses out is in its lack of power. A system this open demands orchestral pieces to be played at levels approaching realism, but this will never be possible unless the monoblocks can be partnered with super-efficient horn loudspeakers. If the production version of the Nephthys is going to be similar to the prototype, but without its blemishes, it may be impossible to live without. It offers a fair slice of the Ongaku's magic without having to hock everything to pay for it. That is Noel Keywood, writing in Hi-Fi World. Oh, basically a very flowery way of describing second harmonic distortion. Anyway, it's strange nobody noticed the natural acoustic and air on Radiofax, as we used to use 805s, the bigger version of the 211, in our modulator of our 6205 transmitter. However, we replaced them with 813s, a more powerful valve, last autumn, increasing the power, as you no doubt noticed, and making the transmitter more efficient in the process. So this is all talking about a valve we've just slung out and for the use of a better one. Some technical details on the valve. The General Electric 211 towers over more modern and compact designs, standing around 7.5 inches high. Its thick tubular glass envelope is about 2.25 inches in diameter. As valves go, this is one of the most impressive looking types to be used in audio, in the Far East, if not in the UK. Not only is its simple electrode structure clearly visible, but being so old a design, it has a bright emitter. As the name suggests, this glows brightly, which consumes a lot of power. 3 amps at 10 volts. In other words, 30 watts just to power one heater. But it looks very pretty. Described by General Electric as a transmitting tube, GE's literature also describes the 211 as a general-purpose 3-electrode tube that can be used for Class A or B audio amplifiers. The plate dissipation is quoted as 100 watts, and in Class B push-pull configuration, the maximum signal plate power is quoted as 260 watts. The trouble is, it's a high-impedance valve of around 4,000 ohms, so it runs at high voltages. That's up to 1250 volts. So 30 watts for the filament and 75 watts anode dissipation, which means over 100 watts just to produce 70 watts of audio. You perhaps understand why we bin the things in order to get more efficiency in our transmitters and save some electricity. But these people are intent on using one of these valves in Class A as an audio amplifier, and they're going to sell it for a lot of money.
In one of Britain's popular newspapers, The Star, a headline, "The Queen is FM, that's flaming mad at Beeb Bunglers." "The Queen is not amused," because gremlins are ruining her favourite radio programmes. Every time she tunes into shows like The Archers, she gets an earful of crackles. Now the Queen has ordered blundering Beeb engineers to sort out poor reception caused by interference from a new transmitter at Windsor Castle. She is an avid radio fan and has put servants in a flap trying to fix her tranny when it packed up in the middle of the night. A royal insider said, "The Queen is very unhappy and wants it sorting out quickly. She loves to listen to current affairs programmes and spends hours tuned into various stations." A new BBC transmitter put up on the castle was supposed to boost reception. But instead, the Queen is getting fuzzy, broken broadcasts from dummy programmes of the new Reading-based Radio Berkshire, which goes on air shortly. The royal source added, "It's very embarrassing for the Beeb after getting special permission to put up their mast. Other families in the castle and in the town are also being badly affected. The dummy broadcasts keep blotting out other stations and it is very annoying," a BBC spokesman said. "We can confirm there have been problems with interference to households within the castle walls." The spokesman said they were racing to install new equipment to filter out the interference. He added, "The new station goes on air officially at the end of the month and has just suffered a few teething problems. This is now being sorted out, and a new piece of equipment which acts as a filtering system is being installed." Well, that is tagged as a Star exclusive by Ian Truman, and we gather from BBC transmission that the root of the problem is an archaic DER distribution system within the castle.
So who in the BBC is going to dare to tell the Queen that it's her nasty old receiver that's causing the interference, not their lovely new transmitters? A slightly different technical problem reported there in the Star.
Holding downward, for it's all.
this week on Sparks, concern grows over gene patenting as American businessmen plan to buy out vital British research, FM interference problems, and interference to the new Sky B comedy channel. Valve lunacy! Did you notice the natural acoustic sound of our 6205 transmitter modulator? The Japanese pay £30,000 for something similar. Enough hype, songs should sell themselves, a report from the US. Russian radio, digital cinema sound, and BBC Radio Berkshire comes on air. Here's a letter from Frank Schuttig in Reichenbach in Germany. He listens on both 6205 and 3910 on an ICF 7600DS and reports both to be good. Also, thanks to John Matthews for writing in. He lives in Talbot Woods in Bournemouth. Your choice of music is appreciated, he says. I was playing with my 1155F and picked up your transmissions on about 6.2 megs, listened for about 30 minutes, and then turned over to my NRD and could pinpoint your frequency exactly. Liked your style, varied and interesting content. He's age 62. And one of his hobbies is a horologist, which means he collects clocks. In radio world, songs should sell themselves. When Capitol Records released the latest album from popular rap artist MC Hammer, now known as Hammer, it proudly backed the package with a publicity blitz worth more than $1 million. Included were $500,000 worth of television adverts, tie-ins to the movie The Addams Family, a Saturday morning cartoon, a new Hammer Barbie doll from Mattel, and a new look commercial from Pepsi, all with hooks to his Too Legit to Quit album. Similarly, the video for Michael Jackson's latest Black and White debuted in mid-November, simultaneously over three TV networks, MTV, Black Entertainment Television, and Fox. The clip generated even more publicity when Jackson exhibited an uncharacteristic display of violence and sexuality. His subsequent apology made headlines nationwide. Whether sincere or a savvy pre-mediated media ploy, the video, which cost a reported $4 million, served double duty as a newsmaker. And before Christmas in Britain, the naughty bits in the Michael Jackson video were censored by the BBC on Top of the Pops and then shown by Channel 4's The Word programme. And very dull they were too, these naughty bits. However, on with the article. While it certainly is nice to see a record company stand behind its artists, I am puzzled. Whatever happened to the days when music spoke for itself? More and more, it seems that hype makes the hit. With such guaranteed exposure behind an artist before a record is even out of the box, it undeniably makes an easier sell to radio. Obviously, Hammer's single, one of the more obnoxious efforts in pop history, debuted on Billboard's Hot 100 at number 61, on the Rhythm and Blues chart at 39, and the LP came in at 3. Jackson, meanwhile, burst onto the Hot 100 at 35, and the Rhythm and Blues chart at 44. That compares with in at number 1 in this country. Were these hits made, or were they bought? When a Huey Lewis and the News song turns up in a beer commercial, while the song is still climbing the chart, when Vanilla Ice makes a deplorable major motion picture to capitalise on and prostitute his music in quotes within, when New Kids on the Block's merchandise sells more than the group's albums, it tells me that the real music to these artists' ears goes to the tune of profit, sales and cash. Somewhere in this era of high-gloss imaging and prodigal publicity, the purity of an artist wanting to share his or her music with the people is long lost in an overpowering tidal wave of merchandising and publicity ad nauseam. Granted, a record company isn't going to back an artist, it doesn't believe it can deliver the goods. But is it right when a singer is guaranteed a radio hit because his or her lunchbox and beach towels are sellouts? I remember talking with a local disc jockey when Paula Abdul's Rush Rush was released later last year. She acknowledged that perhaps one of the disc's less solid cuts was chosen for initial release from Abdul's new Spellbound, because executives knew that the hype behind her new album would create enough momentum to carry the song to number one. So what is radio to do? Turn away a song or artist because his or her hype exceeds comparable talent? Ignore requests from an 8-year-old who wants to hear the latest song by his Saturday morning animated superhero? Of course not. Radio is no victim here. The benefits trickle down nicely to the airwaves. The hype gives folks a reason to tune into radio, while giving stations the opportunity to develop core artists, staple performers that help identify a signature sound. The offence here lies with the artists, who take advantage of their enviable status by giving us less than their best. Phil Collins is the natural example. After a string of number one ballads and horn-based up-tempo hits, the songwriter has lapsed into formulaic music making. His music no longer is the focus. Radio knows that Phil Collins is popular. His voice will attract listeners, and certainly Atlantic Records is behind him. Thus, the quality of the song, or its transparent similarity to yesterday's biggest hit, is peripheral. I realise that no artist today would have a prayer of a chance without marketing, video exposure and a record company support, but maybe if Capital had redirected even $100,000 from its publicity budget, you and I would now be enjoying the music of a forever to be unknown, instead of seeing another Hammer commercial. That's Charles Taylor, writing in the American magazine Radio World.
Yeah.
Slow Start for AM Stereo by Peter Gwynn in Asia Pacific Broadcasting. Radio Television Hong Kong's English-speaking Channel 3 has become the third AM channel in the Far East to offer stereo. The move on July the 15th was followed 1 week later by the on-air debut of Metro Radio's AM channel in stereo. Although AM stereo provides listeners with sound quality similar to that of FM, listeners are not scrambling to tune in. Furthermore, manufacturers and retailers have been loath to offer AM radios equipped with the chip necessary to produce stereo listening on AM frequencies. Although such chips can be cheap, like the Motorola Sequam chip, which costs about $2.5, manufacturers are waiting for more listener interest. On the other hand, without more equipment, there is little push to generate interest among listeners. AM stations broadcasting in stereo have been advertising their services on air, but there has been little publicity otherwise. AM stereo has been a slow mover, said Philip Manns, RTHK's controller of engineering and production services. It's a bit of an uphill battle. AM stereo capability can be found in radio receivers, normally in more expensive models. Sangyan of Taiwan makes Walkman-type AM stereo receivers, which retail for about HK$300. Appropriately equipped car radios are also quite difficult to find. Philips of Holland is one manufacturer, while Japanese car makers Mitsubishi and Honda equip their cars with AM stereo receivers. Listeners who do purchase AM stereo receivers do not regret the extra expense. Although AM stations pick up a lot of interference from distant transmissions at night, changing all transmission to FM is not the answer, particularly in hilly countries, where topography allows little line-of-sight transmission. The fact of life is that there are not enough FM channels to go around, says Manns, so many broadcasters have to stay on AM. You have to get the best you can. AM stereo provides a critical way of doing that. It reduces interference because of the way humans perceive sound. The brain identifies aural images coming from the left and right sides of the head in coherent fashion, that is, in stereo, far better than it can pick up a monaural background sound. Thus, AM stereo serves to blanket out interference from other AM stations, as perceived by listeners, even though the interference still persists. The technology isn't expensive for stations, according to Manns. Radio Television Hong Kong's exciter for AM stereo costs just $15,000. There are some manufacturers who have decided that the technology may be for them. Sony, for example, has developed a new portable AM stereo receiver, although it has not yet announced plans to market it. In Hong Kong, Gold Peak Industries is working on an automatic tuning receiver system that will contain AM stereo capacity. If manufacturers are convinced that the market is there, says Manns, they'll bring out AM stereo receivers. Indeed, stations elsewhere in Asia are seriously studying the possibility of introducing AM stereo. Japanese commercial broadcasters in particular have expressed their interest. In Thailand, there is already preparation among broadcasters to offer AM stereo. Earlier this year, they put up 6 AM transmitters with stereo capability in and around Bangkok. AM stereo only started in Asia 2 years ago, unlike in the US and Australia, where it is quite common. The Broadcasting Corporation of China's AM channel in Taipei, Taiwan, was the first to adopt the technology in Asia. RTHK, Hong Kong's government-owned broadcasting station, launched AM stereo on Channel 5, one of its Cantonese-speaking channels, last October. It extended the technology to its Channel 3 last month, after upgrading its new transmitter in the new territories. A fairly upbeat piece about AM stereo there in Asia Pacific Broadcasting, not mentioning its fairly dismal success in Australia.
Philips, the Dutch electronics giant, has put back the launch of its digital compact cassette from April to September this year, although the company insists there have been no technical or production hitches. A Philips spokesman said full specification DCC machines will start rolling off the production lines for April. Meanwhile, rumours were circulating of a technical hitch in Sony's rival to DCC, the Minidisc, when it did not appear at a show quite recently. You're listening to Sparks, every week on Radio Facts, our programme of media, scientific and technical news. And other Radio Facts programmes start on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. A lot of interesting new things to listen out for. This week's Sparks is presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook.
Gets inside, ooh, through her skin. I've been out before, but this time it's much safer in. Last night, in the sky, ooh, such a place.
Thank you. now it's time for the Radio Achnagat Agricultural Antiques Roadshow. And each week, our roving reporter, ex-Sotheby's man, Rodney Duffer Duffington, heads a wah out and about there into the farms of Buchan to see if it's of interest from yesteryear. And this week, Rodney is coming live from the mains of Slack Tucket, near Clot. Are you there, Rodney, with the Agricultural Antiques Roadshow? Well, hello, listeners, and welcome to the Radio Achnagat Agricultural Antiques Roadshow. Hey, Roddy Duffer Duffington here. Awfully glad to be back amongst you once again. Yes? Now, I'm standing here in the farmyard at the mains of Slack Tacket, and with me is the farmer, 82-year-old Willie Mutch. Now, Willie, we're standing beside a horse roller. What can you tell the listeners about it?
Nah, we'll maloon there a lot. In fact, very little. My grandfather bought this roller at a rope in Strathbogie maybe 100 years ago. But that's about all I can tell you, maloon. Ah, ha, 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 Willie. Ha, ha. Awfully good. Very droll. Now, Willie, let the experts have a look at it. Yes, Willie, this roller was made by Sellers of Huntley, 1850-1860. It's in pristine condition. And it's a superb example of the pre-welding period. Willie, do you have any idea what this roller might fetch at auction?
Nay, really, Maloon. Nah. A sign sailed at a rope in Gertley maybe 40 years ago. It made echt and sacks.
Oh, ho, ho. Now, Willie, you must have more idea on than that, surely. This roller, if it were to come up at auction, would probably fetch in excess of £50.
Oh, very good, Maloon. That's excellent news. I've another half dozen of them round the back yet.
Well, that's all from the Radio Achnagat Agricultural Antiques Roadshow, and it's back to the studio. And Sandy Cowie, are you there, Sandy? Oh, merci, aye, Chavan and Kneipen on here through the day on swinging Radio Achnagat. And it's time now for a song, and we have a new song on the turntable for you, written and sung on this recording by a failed tractor driver from 5A. It's entitled The Glens of Foundland. Now, you'll lock in the glens, listeners, at the high, clear stretch of country that lies between the towns of Huntley and Inverurie in Aberdeenshire, the Glens of Foundland.
Glens of Foundland, you're a wild and lonely place, and I see the changing seasons on your face. The springtime will come again, the wild flowers bloom with joy, and the gurgling stream will sing to a little boy. Was here in the glens I grew and strove to be a man. 'Twas here I learned my trade to work upon the land, to throw the farrow's draught, to help a man's to kind, to work in nature's why we all had moods and sighs. Here in the glens I met the lassie, oh so fair, and we walked by the Ifan side with the sunlight in her hair. She'd come when the work was done, or run by the craggy brae, and she'd tell me I was grand, and she'd love me all her days. Twas autumn in did a lot, for she promised they'd come back before the winter snow. But the winter come and went, the lassie come a mare, down by the Eifel side, and the craggy grave was bare. The sunlight in her hair, but the glens they stood me weel, and way them I will bide till the final day of rest, down by the Eifel side.
Some Scottish folk music. Part of Colin Campbell's local radio. Quite an extraordinary tape sent to me by Andrew Preece. This guy goes around Scotland with this act of his, presumably, and does imitations of imaginary Scottish radio stations and plays his accordion. Well, here's a late entry to our recent competition. Robert Foote. The question you asked was, what date did Radio Facts start this year? As the programme was presumably recorded in 1991, but broadcast in 1992, this could be construed as a fiendishly clever trick question, with this year referring to 1992, in which case the answer would be that you began broadcasting this year, 1992, on January the 1st. However, this is just a bit of New Year-itis on my part, and you were obviously referring to 1991, so the correct answer is Friday, April the 19th. Well, Robert, for sending in such a shrewd answer, you also win a copy of the 1992 Radio Listener's Guide.